Well, something wrong somewhere. Could you start by giving us your name for the purposes of this recording and describing how you came to work in connection with the grain industry?
Well, my full name is Emrys Talvrin Morgan. I go by Tal. I lived across the street from a gentleman by the name of Peter Fraser, who was 2IC of the Government Grain Inspection in 1951. I graduated from Port Arthur Tech in 1951, and I had started to work for LA Green as an apprentice, and not too happy. And Mr. Fraser came across the road one night and said, "Have you got a job?" At which point I said, "Yes." He said, "Oh," he said, "I was going to offer you a job with the government." I said, "Well," I said, "when could I start?" And he said, "Tomorrow." I said, "I'll be there." So that is the way I got involved in the grain business.
And at that time, the department, the organization was still called
Canadian Grain
which was the
Commission.
Canadian Grain Commission already in 1951.
Yeah.
And so you worked there from 1951 until your retirement.
38, 20 years ago, okay, 1950, or
19
1989.
89.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
Very good.
during that time, I think I was laid off maybe twice on seasonal layoffs, but other than that, one job for my working years.
That sounds like a very happy situation given the ups and downs of the economy that
Yes.
occurred through those years. So
Yes.
even on a seasonal basis, you worked through most of the winters.
Yes, and the couple of times that I got laid off because I was a temporary seasonal appointment at that time, I got was lucky enough to get into the mill for the month and a half or 2 months that I was off, and at that time, the mills were on three shifts. The elevators were actually on one shift, and if shipping or unloaded required, they'd be working 3 hours overtime of a night. And I thought, gee, though, that's better. The government's got better hours than the mills at that time. So when navigation opened up and they gave me a call, "Do you want to come back?" Both times I came back. So
How long did it take before you were permanent staff with the Grain Commission?
about five years,
5 years.
and then became temporary, and then it was seasonal. It was subject to layoff if it was required. But in those years, every second year, the elevators would be doing their audit, which required extra people. So I was fortunate enough that to be kept on pretty well. Like I say, other than the two or three, I think it was twice that I got laid off, maybe for a month and a half or so during the winter.
How large a staff did the commission have at the time? Do you have a sense of that?
Oh, we had to have a couple of hundred
A
anyway.
couple of hundred people.
Yes, yeah.
Quite an organization.
Yes,
Yeah.
yeah.
So, what did you find yourself doing then with the Grain Commission?
Well, when I first started, I worked up in the grain exchange, which was over Chapel's third and fourth floors of Chapel's store. And up there, it was a case of when the samples came in from the elevator, from the cars that were being unloaded and the boats that were being unloaded, they were retained for the car unload samples were retained for 30 days, and so they had to be put in tins and ticketed and put away on the shelf, and the shipment samples were kept for a year, and they were kept on the third floor, and again they had to be tinned up and be available if there was a question arose at unloading, or if the farmer or whoever owned the grain at unloading wasn't satisfied with his with the grade that he had received. He had an opportunity to call for a survey on it, and he had the 30 days, and retain the samples for that time. After that, at the end of 30 days, they were dumped. So it was an ongoing thing, unloading or filling the cans today and then dumping them from that were 30 days spent. So
part of your day, well, I suppose they would be coming in through the day, but whatever.
Basically, they're picked up for 1 o'clock, and then as the inspectors up there want to look at samples, we would clean them up and prepare them ready for them to look at. And they had a moisture testing room, so we ran moisture tests on the samples that were required as well. Mm-hmm. So it was there's a fair amount of variety, and it. There's always wires, what we called wires, which was would come in from the telegraph at that time, a farmer or an owner wanted us to look at another sample. So it meant going down the aisles and finding that particular sample and bringing it out, preparing it for the inspector to look at to decide whether or not the grade that was put on at the elevator by the government inspector there was satisfactory, or if it should be up or lower grade. So
I see. So there was a fair amount of work of that sort. Farmers were questioning the grade or wanted to be reassured, getting a second opinion on it.
Oh yeah, I remember there's time we had maybe 30, 40, 50 samples a day that we would have to bring off the shelf for reinspection by the inspectors up in the grain exchange.
Did you get any kind of sense of the proportion that were successful, if you will, that led to an improvement in grade?
As I remember, there wasn't. If it was one that was, the owner might even call for what was called a forward sample, in which case we would take half of the sample that we had here and put it in a bag, and it would be sent to Winnipeg for the Winnipeg office to take a look at, and possibly if it was an agent sample or even a farmer sample, they could actually go into the grain exchange in Winnipeg, and you know, for their satisfaction to see that it was the grain that they were talking about. So
the commission was based in Winnipeg, I guess.
Yes,
was it?
Yeah.
That was where the boss was. Yeah. Also, of course, closer to the farmer, so the farmer could come in and be satisfied.
That's right.
By comparison of his sample with other samples, that he's getting a good grade.
Yeah.
The work that you did, in some ways, was, I don't know what the right word, menial work or whatever, sort of clerk's work, although it involved handling these things. Were you being trained in the process of doing this work, which had to be done, obviously?
Well, actually, the inspectors that were looking at the samples quite often would say, "Go on here, take a look at this. Here's something that we don't see that often." And it might be a variety of the grain, or it might be a weed seed or something that was in there. So this was a learning process in that regard. Now that I was up in the sample room for maybe 4 or 5 months at that time. There was other times that I was up there as well, but when you went out to the elevator, it was a situation where first thing when the cars, box cars at that time, were today we have the tankers, but it was the box cars, and in an elevator like Pool 7, you'd have 5 tracks, and each one had a dumper on it, and each dumper would dump 20 cars in the morning and 20 cars in the afternoon. So there's 100 cars that would go through during the 8-hour shift. When the cars come in, they would have a ticket on them, which indicated the station that they were shipped from, possibly the grade, and all these were taken off the car, basically by a member of the weighing staff. And they, at that time, they would, if the door would be opened by an elevator employee, and they would look in and they would assess the load line in the car. And then the tickets would come to the elevator, and they would write out what we call shunts, which would be maybe 6 or 7 or 8 cars on a sheet, which indicated the car number of the station and the type of grain. Mm-hmm. Then our job as samplers would be to obtain a sample from each of those cars as it was unloaded. Now, in earlier times, they didn't have automatic samplers, but during my time, there was automatic chain-driven samplers, so it was a case of watching to make sure when the car was completely dumped and the hopper was empty, we would retrieve the sample in a bucket, take it up to to our office, make sure that the right information, the right ticket goes in it, and then an inspector would look at it and put the grade on it.
So there would be one sample generated from each car by this particular device that was pulling it out as the grain flowed, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Now, once the inspector had assigned a grade to it, in the meantime, the weighing staff have weighed that car, and if it is close to what the load line that the trackman had put on when he pulled the tickets, okay. If not, then there would be a checking out system that was carried out. But once our inspectors put a grade on it, then all this information had to be recorded. Mm-hmm. So we had dare I say, typical government operation where you had 3, 4, and 5 copies on the paperwork, and Canadian National cars had to be on a separate sheet from Canadian Pacific. Different companies required an extra sheet, so it was on a separate pad. So it all had to be recorded, and then up to the office. And if there was changes made as a result of a survey or a wire being called on a car, change made up in the sample room, then that change had to make sure that change went into the office to change the original paperwork.
Yeah, the original information on the load in the car would have been put on by whom?
The loading elevator out west.
Out in wherever.
Yeah.
And so this was a matter then of either confirming their judgment or varying in terms of, and of course the final decision, subject to this appeal, would be
that's right.
What happened here.
Yeah.
And so the way staff, those were Grain Commission people as well.
Yeah.
How many sections, in a sense, or how many different kinds of things would people be doing, Grain Commission employees?
Well, we had
weighers, samplers.
Weighers, samplers, had entomology, which checked for infestation
of insects and things,
and moisture test lab, which did the moisture test. So I think that was basically the breakdown on the number of staff.
5 different functions, one say.
Yeah,
right. And so you did this. Well, we got the first few months underway. Incidentally, the learning which you were pointing to is rather like that of an apprentice.
Right.
Was it largely apprentice-type learning, or did you sit classes along the way?
No, it was pretty well on your own. There was grading booklets that were available, and variety books that were available. And if you were interested in going further, they were available, but it was up to you. There was exams, and once you got a seasonal appointment, the next step would be an assistant inspector, and usually the assistant inspectors were assisted the inspectors more closely, but they also were the people that were responsible for the loading of the ships. They would be on the ships, and they would take the holes and make sure that the proper grade is going in the proper holes, and that was assistant inspectors step up the the ladder.
Yes,
and then from there, PI 1, classification of 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 being inspector in charge of an elevator, and a PI 5 was a supervisor. So that was the various...
That was as high as it rose here in at the Lakehead.
Yeah.
The person in charge of a...
You just pause for a couple seconds because it takes a while for it to kick in.
We were just talking about the loading of the ship. That's a pretty substantial responsibility, ensuring that the ship is clean, first of all, I suppose, because that's a concern, I suppose, right down the bottom of those holes.
Yeah.
And then there are the various holes in the ship, I suppose, and the cargo might involve a variety of shipments of grain. Mm-hmm. Ships rarely took on everything at one elevator, either, did they not? Did they move from elevator to elevator?
Well, now it's an indication because of the size of them and the difficulty in loading and the volume of the ships now. But back in the 50s and 60s, much smaller vessels.
These were the old Lakers.
The orders were much smaller. You might have a canaler. You could have a barge. If you were starting the loading, then the condition of the vessel was most important, to make sure it was clean and dry and that sort of thing. If it had been loading someplace else, you received a pass-on slip from the previous elevator, which indicated two northern went in two hole, one feet oats went in three. So right away you check your order from your elevator to make sure that the same grade is going into the same holes.
Sure.
That basically was the big thing. Then, in case of inclement weather, you gain knowledge with time on the job, and you looked over your shoulder and you saw a black cloud coming over, and you're at an elevator like Pool 7 that had umpteen pipes and all running grain, you'd sort of advise the grain trimmer, I think we better start covering up before the
so
you don't end up with the whole vessel open and you get caught in a downpour.
Yes, the grain inspector would be a single person from the commission at the ship. How many trimmers would be working a ship?
Well, again, depending on the
size
of the elevator, you get an elevator like Patterson Elevator that I remember because I when we had what we call a flying squad, where an inspector and two samplers moved from elevator to elevator. Patterson had two slots, so you might have maybe four, maybe six fellows.
Trimmers,
and those slots had to be pulled out by hand, where today. They're all operated by power by an operator up on the side of the elevator, and the trimmer just points his finger, and that's where it's put. So that's one area that has drastically changed over the years.
The Grain Commission had, in an overall sense, a responsibility on behalf of the farmers and the Canadian Wheat Board, the sellers of the grain, to ensure that what had been purchased got to the buyer, I suppose.
Yes,
this is where the ship, of course, is going to move it there, and so they're ensuring that it will arrive in the proper form.
Yeah, and the odd time, if especially in the case of barley, barley was going down to Milwaukee and these places for... malt barley for breweries.
Yeah.
Quite often they would have a representative here, and they would be checking the sample as it came in, because when you're loading the boat, if it was a large amount, that's going to take you a couple of hours to load. There would be samples going into our inspector in charge of that particular elevator, maybe every 20 minutes, just to make sure that
the quality.
You couldn't take a chance on waiting till the boat was loaded to find out that there's something wrong. And there was situations where the final grade was not up to what was ordered, and a couple of the elevators here have marine legs, and they would back the boat under the marine leg and have to take it off and rectify the problem.
I see. Well, what's the nature of malting barley as against, let's say, feed barley?
Well, the malting barley was process in a lot of cases was started at Canada Malt, the malting process. So they could ship malt out of Canada Malt.
But when it comes off the farm, what's distinctive about a malting barley or a barley that will be malted?
Higher grade, the maturity.
Is it primarily grade?
Yeah.
And I suppose a farmer could bring in barley and the agent at the elevator could decide that it was of malting quality, I suppose.
Well, you could then see that you'd want all 2-row barley or all 6-row. You wouldn't want a mixture, and sometimes you'd get a mixture which your grade would end up being a feed, a feed grade.
Because it was a mixture.
But they would, for malting barley, you want a 2-6-row or a 2-2-row top quality.
These would be varieties of barley, that grew in different types.
And that was another thing that the inspection people, I'm trying to remember, we had a box that was about 18 inches by 12 inches, and they had the small like medicine bottles in there, and that was full of different varieties that was part of the requirement when you became an inspector to be able to identify all these varieties, because some of them were of a top grade variety and others were strictly a feed variety.
This wasn't just barley in this. One of the distinctive features of Canadian grain production is visual identification, isn't it?
Yes.
Just glance at it and you know what it is.
That's right, yes.
The breeding has been focused towards that among other objectives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how then did you move up in the commission or advance from these first months and then the first several years when you were moving?
Well, the opportunity came to write exams, like for the assistant, and you had to get the marks that were set, and there was an allotment, so to speak, of so many assistant inspectors, so many P1s, so many P2s, depending on how many elevators were operating and the demand.
Yeah. And primary
products inspector.
Primary products inspector. So it's PPI in a sense. Although I take it it went as simply as PI.
Yeah. So like say as the requirement come, the word would be out and say it looks as if they're going to have an exam for assistant inspector. In which case, if you're interested, you put in an application and then you should went scurrying around trying to find books and get a much spare. If you happen to be a spare at the elevator, not bringing samples in off the track, your job was to tie up the bags and take the bag down to the box for the driver to pick up. Then you'd get into the benches as much as you could, look over their shoulder and ask a quick conversation with the inspectors, and the majority of them were quite good. Say, "Quan, get over here, clean this sample up for me. And let me know when you got it ready," and which would mean weighing it, possibly doing a moisture test on it in the elevator, determining how much dockage was in it by putting it over the small cleaning machines we had in the office. The standard practice at certain times, certain years, stones were showing up in the grain quite often. They said, "No, make sure you throw the whole 500 grams out and check to make sure if there's any stones or in it." There'd be times when that would be standard practice, and there'd be other times say, "Well, the likelihood of it would be just take a quick look at it and satisfy the."
Do you have a sense of why there were stones in the grain some years?
Well, if the combines were set down too low and they'd pick it up, and I say the majority of it would be removed, but there was always the possibility that you might get some.
Because they really have to be running the the pickup pretty low to the ground in order to pick up stones.
It wasn't, like I say, it wasn't a, in some cases, in the case of shipments, it was much a guarantee that there isn't stones into it.
Yes, yes, quite.
Because I remember once, if not twice, them getting a complaint from Europe on a shipment that they found stones in a shipment. And like I say, we retained the shipping samples for a year.
Yes.
Down to the third floor, bring all the samples up, go through, not find one single stone in our sample. They say, well, where is this? And then they, the boss in his, in his wisdom, and that's the reason we have bosses, said, give me the map. And of course, get the map, and the location that was doing the complaining was quite a bit inland, up a river, and they had to take all the grain up there on a barge. Mm-hmm. And coming the other way, it was coming from a rock quarry, coming down. And I guess they hadn't cleaned all the grit and one thing another from the down trip, and it got in the grain. Yeah. But you know, we had the proof that our grain going out of here was
sure, stone free.
Was okay, stone free. Yes.
Well, I asked the question partly because there were years when farmers had big crops and couldn't sell them in storage. Mm-hmm. In some of those years, before they bought all the steel tanks and so on to store it, they might end up dumping it on the ground and having it conceivably, you know, so, but that would be more soil even than stones.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have that. Well, during my time, there really wasn't that much of a problem. But there,
I wouldn't
there,
think
there
so.
Would be
actually,
would be the occasion, and it, you know, 3 to 5 stones in a. In a 500 gram, and it.
My father would never let my brother and myself run the combine. He always did it himself. But the main concern on the farm, which he had to clear in terms of, you know, breaking the bush, if you will, and getting the trees off, and so on and so forth, was roots that would work their way out. And he was always afraid of one of those roots being picked up and going through, and you. Smashing the separator in the combine, so he would run it himself. And so I can understand bits of wood as a possibility, but stones seem very difficult to for the pickup actually to, which is running in the front of the combine and bringing
when I'm seeing stones are the size of a kernel of grain.
Yeah, you know, well, particularly that sort of stuff. You know, where would that come from? A quarry, an adult, a polluted barge. I can certainly understand as against the farmers doing this. Yeah. But it's these are interesting points in terms of
one of the
quality of the cargo.
One of the things that I remember that the when I started, it was all the small box cars, and there were some elevators that had what we call shovels, which was approximately a 3 by 3 foot by 3 foot hardwood board attached to a cable, and the fellow would get in there and run as far into the back of the car as he could, and then the panel would bring the grain out to the door. That was one of the tough jobs in the elevator, and again before the time of proper dust masks and stuff like that, and it where today with the with the tankers, the majority of grain that comes down that's shipped now is in the tankers, and it's just a case of putting a power crank on the bottom of the hopper, and it's empty. And it, and I remember the dumpers that farmers would come from out west and for a visit, and you know, 3 to 5 minutes the boxcar would be empty. You know, and they'd stand there amazed. They said, "Do you have any idea how long it took us to load that? You know, it took us 2 days or 3 days. Of course, wheelbarrowed and you know, hand bombing it. So, that was one of the big things that, you know, sort of caught your attention that you didn't really think too much about. It just put it on, dump it, and put another one on.
So these were farmers who were working with platforms at sidings, I suppose.
That's right, yes.
And they'd ask for a car and then load the thing themselves, which most farmers I don't think ever did. They had the advantage of a line elevator and in came the wagon or the truck more likely.
But they had those small screw gas-powered screw conveyors, you know, that they would... Mm. They would
Well, that's true. The when with an auger is what you're describing, or even the older elevators, which some farmers still remember seeing them, which with the chain running and the steel plate at 8 or 10 inch, 12 inch interval or whatever, and it would be pulling it up a canvas. But the augers screw in a pipe were much more efficient, and of course by that means they could be dumping it into the little hopper at the lower end of the auger, and up it would go into the. It would still take a while to fill a boxcar.
Yes, definitely. Yes.
And I can understand their being astonished at it was that quick the emptying of a boxcar here. Now, of course, the joy of being a grain inspector was that you could watch that activity.
Oh, yes.
You didn't have to get in there.
No, I didn't at all.
You mentioned dust, of course. And, there was be dust all around, of course, in the elevators here in those days.
Oh, yes. It was, you could look out and dust in the air. And I remember coming home and my wife, as soon as I'd step in the back door, there would be occasion when she'd say, "You were shipping rye today, or you were shipping malt barley today," because it would be on your clothes and working in it, you didn't give it a second thought. But other people, it's like you.
But she got she recognized she could, the different
she could,
smell.
She could smell it. Yeah, she could tell us all. It's like somebody in the house across the on the back deck smoking today. You know, you could smell it right away.
Yes,
but it. And like I say, we didn't. The elevators didn't have the pollution control that they have. They all had a burner out the back that all the straw and stuff like that. Where today it's into the bin and hauled out to the landfill.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fire going behind every elevator on a permanent basis. Because all the straw and mm-hmm. that kind of stuff would all. Burnt right on the right at the elevator.
This would include some of the dockage as well, would it?
Well, whatever was waste was burnable, and it when it comes to the dockage, a lot of that stuff went into what was called screenings, which is the end of ground up feed, but it so that type of thing added to the pollution that was quite evident at that time.
When did concern about the dust as an occupational health matter arise? I presume it did during your working life.
I don't know whether whether I noticed that dust mass and some of that became more readily available.
When would that have been? As late as the 70s?
I would say possibly into the 70s and again ear defenders and stuff like that the fellows working in the car shed and the railway running 40 cars in the car shed and did bang 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 bang, and we never really gave it any thought. We had we got to the point where we had to, they said you have to have hard hats, but I can never remember anybody saying or seeing reading anywhere you had to have safety footwear.
You know, throughout your working life.
Yeah, it did. No, that's.
Did you begin wearing steel toes?
I never wore steel toes all the time. I
street shoes.
No. I mean, there were some that did, mm-hmm. of their own choice.
Yes.
But like I say, it wasn't mandatory, and it wasn't even suggested.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you know.
And occupational health considerations, of course, could be raised by a union, conceivably, or by a health and safety committee or whatever. Was there any organization of that sort in the Grain Commission? Were you members of a union or?
Well, we had a union. I really can't remember a big movement or a big push on anything. You know, the odd time somebody would get hurt, and at that time say, well, you know, you shouldn't have been doing this, and or we should there should have been a bar here for the buildings that we worked in. Basically, the elevator, it was their responsibility, and they provided office space for us. Mm-hmm. But you know, they'd have the signs up that, you know, no admittance here, and safety situations.
And there was, of course, an enormous array of elevators along the waterfront in those days.
I started to think after I received your letter, I think I got up to 18. And I mentioned it at another gathering, and they said, well, you didn't get them all.
So it did. I've heard numbers as high as 30 plus. So I'm going to put such a list together using the resources, I suppose, at the Historical Museum, first of all, and maps and so on and so forth. But
well,
there were,
again, when
you had 18, so you've been in quite a variety of elevators.
When I was up in the sample room, the first thing in the morning, the fellow that ran took care of the samples the work that was required on the boat floor, would go up to Lake Shippers, and their office was on the top floor at Chapels, and get the lineup for the boats. Mm-hmm. And we had a blackboard with all the elevators listed. And I remember mornings when there would be a boat at every elevator and three written across the bottom, waiting to come in.
Yeah, those were the days.
Oh, it's when you stop and think. And of course, slower loading, smaller boats.
Yes.
One of the big things now that I notice, the length of the shipping season. Mm-hmm. The 15th of December used to be the end of the shipping season. And if you had a boat at the dock, as long as the lines were off, as long as it was not tied to the dock, and I remember, I think it was Gringer was the one situation I remember, they wanted another couple of drafts, 2,000 bushels or something, to run in, and the guy said, it's 12 o'clock, take the lines off, the ice will hold it up against the dock while you run that in, and by 20 after 12 or 12:30, the lines were off at 12 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. And the shipping was finished.
Shipping was finished. And now no insurance after.
I see. And these days they run through at the end of the month, sometimes into January briefly if possible.
Well, almost year round. You know, just a month or so, depending on the severity of the ice.
Yes, what kind of winter we've got.
Yeah.
Availability of icebreakers and all of that. The winter shipping by rail had occurred in some years, or was it fairly general that there would be some continuing movement?
Fairly general. Once the shipping stopped, and then they would, if they were going to do a inventory of stocks and everything, that would be done, and then they'd be into shipping, and there would be, I remember, I don't know how general a happening it was, but I remember two occasions where buyers came up late in the fall, and they wanted a bin. It was in one case it was Durham. They want for your spaghetti and mm-hmm. pasta. They wanted the elevator to run a bin, and they looked at it and they accepted it, and they said, okay, put a lock on the bin, and starting in such and such a date, we want you to start shipping that down boxcar at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have supply of their required grade, during the winter. Mm-hmm. Canada Malt, I think, was another one that shipped malt to the breweries down in the States on a regular basis during the winter.
So they would send it by rail around Lake Superior first, I suppose, and then across into Michigan, or would it go even further?
No, they
than come that?
Go through down Duluth Way and down through.
Oh, from Winnipeg.
Yeah, go west and then down. Yeah.
Right. Well, yes, of course you could have. Yeah. That's right. You could ship it back to Winnipeg and then have it on. And I guess that.
But they had there, like I say, there was a number of companies and. You get a company that was ordering malt, very very specific. They sent out sort of a fiber coverall that anybody that was doing the loading had to wear these coveralls, and they had to have the paper boots that came out over their shoes, and their hair covered.
I see.
Couldn't take a chance of a piece of hair or anything else like that getting into the malt, into the brewery, into the malt.
The barley would be going straight into the into the vats or whatever, I suppose.
Yeah,
would
it very be? Very careful on the loading of barley was. So
have you done much work with malting barley up here?
No, not really.
No.
When I was over working in the sample room as a sampler, one of the jobs you get would be going over to what we call D&S Mill, which is what used to be the mattress factory over on the river at Intercity. Mm-hmm. And they specialized in oats. Mm-hmm. And they would take a couple of cars of oats in, and they had special cleaners that they would clean every seed and every wild oat out of it. And I remember the one that it comes to attention, they had special brand bags that were shipped up from the States with Bing Crosby's name on it, strictly for his racehorses, and there was 50 bags, and every bag had to be, every bag went back, no bag, they didn't, there wasn't any extra, but direct shipment and direct order from racehorse owners down in the States came right up to D&S Mill here.
To get the pure oats.
Just the prime feed, yeah. Too good for humans, but just what we need for the horses.
Yeah, because the wild oats was just an unacceptable adulteration.
Oh, yeah.
There just couldn't be any of the...
you know, it might be one in your entire sample that you obtained. So.
Well, no point to... brooding over horses and being fed well, I guess. The horses were worth it, I suppose.
Yeah.
And did you have experiences with other unusual cargoes? Malting barley, in a sense. Oats, in this case.
No, not it. One of the things in shipping, when you had the package freighters had... two decks in the holds. And the first couple of times I was on a boat, I was terrified because they'd be running into the lower hole, and they would have to get the grain to the outside, and the trimmers would plow the grain. And so they had a metal plow, looked like a flat wheelbarrow, actually is what it started to look like, but they would throw that down into the hole, and they would jump in and get it underneath the spout of the grain coming in, and they could direct that to the far corners and plug every hole. That guy will never get out of there. But they would. That was one of the jobs of the trimmers.
We've had to interview a trimmer or two along the way. I hope they're still alive. I imagine there are.
And then when they would have to hand shovel the flax in the holes.
Oh my, yes.
And they had the special shovels that they handmade, all made out of wood, and again something specially to the trade.
The ships in question here were ones that carried package freight on the upper deck or whatever.
Yeah.
As long as that business went on until the early 70s, I guess, when CSL gave it up.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess the buses or trucks took over completely on that particular work. Yeah. But they were, so these ships were doing double duty.
Bring up loads of apples and take loads of grain back down.
I see. Now the apples would come up in boxes, I presume.
Yeah, that's bushel baskets.
Round bushel baskets?
Tubs.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, we haven't thought about the reverse business when we were preoccupied with grain moving out.
Yeah, yeah.
Are there any other elements, aspects of return cargo? Did the ships, many of the ships come up in ballast, or did they usually have a cargo?
Oh, no, most of them come up in ballast.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Water ballast chiefly.
Yeah. Like I say, your small package freighters would mm-hmm. be the difference.
It would be the exception to the general rule.
Yeah.
Yes. Do you have memories of the appearance of ocean shipping and then of course gradually the growth of the ships that were operating thanks to the St. Lawrence Seaway after 1959, I guess it is.
Yeah, I remember when the salties starting to come, and again it was sort of terrifying because the language was a big thing, and of course the size of some were so much bigger than what we'd been accustomed to, and the fact that you'd go back aft because all the superstructure was back aft there. Quarters and everything, and geez, you could get lost back there without any trouble at all.
Yeah.
And but it was quite a bit different. I think the language was the big concern,
mm-hmm.
and they were the mates and the captains, and rightly so. This is my boat. and you won't do anything, or you won't move it, or you won't start, or you won't shut off, unless I say so.
Yes.
And you know, this is...
Yeah.
No argument.
A ship is definitely a dictatorship in that sense.
Yes.
The captain and
yes.
first mate and so on and so forth.
Yeah. But like I say, the majority, I can never remember having a problem. You know, mm-hmm. you have concerns, but I can never remember having a problem with that.
So your presence on these ships, involvement with grain trade at this point, would be as an assistant inspector, I suppose.
Well,
this
more
time.
Likely, even for P1s, ended up going on the boats as well. So,
what was your own progress through the structure? When did you become an assistant inspector? Walk us through it.
Let's start this in just a second. And
so we've taken a break, and you've picked up a piece of paper that records your movement through the ranks. And I gave it a very quick glance. I didn't really note it. And perhaps you could walk us through it, your movement up in the Grain Commission.
Well, I entered the service on July the 26th, 1951. And I was appointed a seasonal sampler in March of 1954. Permanent sampler, which meant that not very likely you would get laid off. As a seasonal, you could get laid off at the end of shipping season. But then permanent sampler in 56, assistant grain inspector in 61.
So that's almost 10 years after.
Yeah. And at that time, anybody that had ex-service time,
military
time, automatically went to the top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody that didn't, which was my case, regardless of what your marks were, you came after anybody that had service.
This would be in the context of writing an examination or the competition or whatever.
Yeah, regardless of where you came.
Ex-servicemen always got the advantage.
Yeah.
Veterans preference.
Yeah. So then Inspector PI-1 in 65, a 2 in 68. I can't remember when I became a 3. And these are different different levels. A large elevator like Pool 7 had 4 grading mats in the office. So you could have maybe a 1, a 2 twos, and a 3, and a 4 in a smaller elevator. You might just have maybe a 2 and a 3. So the size of the elevator sort of dictated the number of inspectors you had.
And were there differences in the work done, or was it matter to some extent
level
of responsibility in terms of the size of an elevator?
The responsibility, basically. If if the elevator was working overtime, then it said, okay, you have to have a 3.
Mm-hmm.
You can be the inspector in charge is a 4. Could be working, but if he didn't want to work or for whatever reason, mm-hmm. then as long as you had a 3, then you had to have a 3.
So this was to some extent the privilege of rank in terms of getting more hours.
Yes. So at a 4 in 71, and then I was promoted to a PI-5 supervisor in November of 85.
And you were working for another 4 years or so.
89. Yeah.
So this had you at just short of the top of.
Yeah.
Or were you in charge of the? As a supervisor,
As a supervisor, we had four PI-5s, and so as a supervisor, you would have grain growers elevator. Pool 9, Pool 4, Richardson's, and Pool 6, North End.
Mm-hmm.
So as a supervisor, that was your responsibility.
Another whole group of elevators.
Another supervisor would have Pool 3, Canada Malt, mm-hmm. 7A, 7B, and then you'd have one up the river to Searle and Grand Trunk and those...
Patterson,
something. Mm-hmm. So that's the way it was was broken down. As you were in charge of that those elevators and staffing to see if they're properly staffed and if there was vessels in, you had enough staff for inwards and outwards. So
and this was genuine supervision. It was the organization of the staff, ensuring you weren't doing any frontline work by that time.
No.
And was there someone? On top of that whole organization, one person in charge of the whole, overseeing everything.
We had two up in the office, or the district inspector in charge.
District inspector in charge.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And he had three under him.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a fairly extensive staff in the up in the grain exchange.
Yes. Well, that's been very useful to have it laid out so neatly and to explore the sorts of things. So one of the, we've been using, I suppose, question 5, please describe a typical day, which I hadn't asked you, as the pretext for working our way through your life. But maybe was there such a thing as a typical day for the earlier and then for the later stages or not? I'm thinking PIs 1 through 4 anyway would be mostly doing the same sort of work, I gather.
Inspecting the samples as they come in and grading them, and at the inspector level, the responsibility that you had increased with as you went up the ladder.
Yes. Did you ever find the work getting boring, too routine, or was there a variety in it that made the work more interesting?
There was. I was very fortunate. As an inspector in charge, a PI-4, you usually changed elevators every year. So you got to know the elevator staff, and sometimes the a number of your of our staff would change at the same time. But the inspector in charge would change every year. I guess it was the fair thing to do because you have an elevator the size of Pool 7 that's got takes in 100 cars in the morning, 100 cars in the afternoon, and the fellow over at Pool 9 is getting paid the same money, and he's taken six this week. So the variety of positions and the operation of the various elevators was quite different.
There were years when you really earned your keep.
Yeah, that's
and there
that's
were
right.
years when you rested a little bit on your laurels.
Mm-hmm. So this is like I say, they would change every year for the inspector in charge. So.
Did you find the grain companies themselves different, their staffs? You've mentioned, of course, different sizes of elevators and different amounts of throughput. Were there other differences as well amongst the various companies?
Not really. I can't remember having being at an elevator where I dreaded going to work in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
They were all, you know, first name basis, and especially when you got to the point of the inspector in charge,
mm-hmm.
they knew that you were the inspector in charge,
yeah.
and you represented the government, and
mm-hmm.
you know they had to toe the line, and if they were having problems that they couldn't rectify, quite often they would come and say, look, we're in this situation because this is what's happened. You know, how can we take care of it?
Yeah.
I had good cooperation with all the ones that I was fortunate enough to work
sure.
with.
You were a little bit like a captain or a mate on the ship, I guess.
captain.
once you were a great inspector in charge of at an elevator.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, what should we say? What would you like people to know about the work that you did and the places you worked?
Well, I think that the responsibility that we had to the producer, to the farmers out west, you know, and a lot of times they, well, those government guys, you know, be that good or bad, you know, that I'd always look at it and say, well, you know, This wasn't grown overnight, and somebody's put a lot of time and effort into it. They say, oh well, don't bother with that. No, that it calls for more than that, you know, and try to be as fair and as honest, and like I say, the rules and regulations that were in effect at that time were put in after much study, and let's keep up our end of the bargain.
Yeah. Were you given any kind of sense, however it might develop, of the development of the grain inspection system in Canada as a protector, the farmer at one end and of the markets or the buyers at the other end in terms of quality? Was there any kind of esprit de corps in the Grain Commission along those lines?
I think for the most part that there definitely was, that it you know, we were in the middle, and we certainly had an obligation to the farmer in bringing it in, and an equal obligation to whoever has purchased it or is receiving it, and the fact that it. The end result we could end up having on our table tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know.
There's my tummy too.
this is one of the things that would cross your mind every once in a while. And
there wasn't much talk amongst the inspectors. people didn't come through and give you pep talks about the commission or about Canada's grain inspection system, or was there any kind of journal, a newspaper, anything of that sort?
No, not really. And they had every once in a while they would have a seminar in Winnipeg for 3 or 4 days, or maybe for a week or 2 weeks. And when you got to the inspector level, you would go up to Winnipeg, and they would be on the grain, overall grain operation. I went on to Quebec and Montreal once with another inspector, and we toured all the operation down there so that you had a better idea of what was happening to the product and the vessels after they left here, which was I found very interesting and very beneficial. Mm. And it you went to Winnipeg because they have the facilities there. They're baking bread and they're showing you what happens with this kind of wheat against this kind of wheat and the kind of macaroni and spaghetti that this type of durum provides, as opposed to this, which again are I think the majority of fellows that attended those found them very, very beneficial.
Quite enriching, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely, yes.
Did you have much interaction with the Wheat Board, which was the sort of the Canadian agent to sell the grain?
No.
And they didn't. Did farmers come to the Lakehead very often? I think you mentioned earlier.
They used to. They would come in and we'd always get after them. Well, you're on your way to Florida for the winter. You thought you'd drop in and see what was happening, and they would take it in good turn. Could I imagine some of them were going to Florida, but in talking to non family members, it's not quite as easy as you're putting it to be. You know, there's more to it than. Yeah. The planting, harvesting, and going to Florida. So.
Yeah. Well, the great distinction was between the mixed farmer and the grain farmer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So anyone who had livestock and all the rest of it was tied to the farm, yeah, especially if they had kept some cows. They've got to be milked morning and evening, and it's a terrible tyranny, that. But mm-hmm. someone who only grew grain could, in fact, go away for some months and come back as the snow disappeared and get ready to.
Yeah.
Unless they were in the machine shed, of course, making sure the machinery was all in shape for the spring, which could keep them busy too.
One of the oddities that happened while I was on was the year that they had the damp grain, and they brought in portable dryers. So we had pool two elevators, which is the one that's not operating now. I remember it had four or five portable dryers that they had along the side of the tanks there, and they were running 24 hours a day trying to dry the grain that was coming in. And I think that seems to me it only happened once, but it was a really, really big problem.
Really,
of course, once it starts to, the moisture gets in, it starts to sprout and starts to ferment, and
wonder whether would that have been sometime conceivably in the late 50s, or would it have been later than that?
I think it would have been later than that. I'm not quite sure. I wouldn't guess for that.
I do remember one fall being very wet, and Dad having my brother and myself out on the fields. It seems to me it may have been Remembrance Day. It was that late. He was taking off the flax, finally, when the fields were frozen, so he could drive the combine on the ice in order to harvest the flax. I remember that day chiefly because it was very cold, and I guess the sides on the engine compartment on the truck were open, and I guess I reached my hand in to warm them a little bit, and forgetting that the fan was spinning. It didn't break the skin, but to have your finger drummed even for, you know, kind of a split second by a spinning fan on an engine is a sensation you don't forget very soon.
Got your attention anyway.
Oh, it certainly did. Yeah. But that was one example, one fall that was incredibly wet. But there were surely others as well. Mm-hmm. My father was out of farming by... Well, I was off the farm by 1960 myself, actually, pretty well, and so on. The another of the questions here is, what might interest or surprise people most about the work you did? And each of these questions is designed, of course, to elicit any really, you know, fascinating memories you can dredge up.
I think that the majority of people would find it hard to believe that we were capable of telling one kernel of grain against another.
Yeah, recognizing the grain.
The variety. The variety were, we spent hours and hours and hours. Well, and the thing is, if you're going to be an inspector, you had to get passing marks on them.
Yes.
And that's all there was to it. And it, they had a couple of... variety expert. Well, we claim they claimed they were variety experts. Come down from Winnipeg on a regular basis, and they would call the up. They get a group up in the sample room after when all the rest of the work was done, and instead of getting an early quit, get the varieties out and go through. And this is this, and this is this, and we brought this to your attention. And like I say, it was an ongoing thing, and it during my time, I would say, I think maybe a third of the varieties that were on when I went on the job were no longer grown when I came off.
Well, for the listening laity here, you might just run through some of those varieties. I have a bit of a sense as a farmer's son. But you're talking now, let's say in the case of wheat, of new varieties being put on the market.
Yeah.
And the names, can I press your memory a bit?
Oh, gosh.
So of course, there was a time when Red Fife, I guess, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
Now
Marquis was the standard.
I wasn't going to say the word. Marquis is, in fact, the term that was used by Canadians, wasn't it? Marquis rather than, say, Marquis. It was Marquis.
Yeah.
That and that came in around 1907, I think, give or take, somewhere. Saunders, I think, were involved with the breeding of Marquis, were they not?
I read, but let's say Marquis was the standard of quality, and any variety that qualified for the top grade, that was it. Marquis or equal to,
right?
In variety. And the thing is, there were people want to say, well, why did you have to know? Well, there were certain varieties because of their shape. Basically, and their milling quality weren't as valuable a product. You didn't get as valuable a product from it, so therefore they didn't qualify for your top grades.
Yeah.
So they ended up either in a lower grade or a feed grade.
Right.
In the case of your barley and six row and two row barley. So.
Well, when you started in the 50s, Marquis was not the prevailing variety. Even at that point, was it?
No,
or was it
just by name?
Yeah,
I can never remember seeing a variety of Marquis.
No, this was sort of set the standard, but there were other varieties. And
oh yes,
do you remember any of them?
offhand, I don't.
Not
remember.
Off the top of your head. And I'm not really connecting either with the varieties of wheat that were available. This was, of course, an ongoing job for the plant scientists of Canada, both the government and universities and so on, breeding new varieties of wheat and so on. There's a fascinating article in the Equinox magazine more than 20 years ago about one of the leading breeders, and it has a lot to say about it, particularly about the importance of this visual distinguishability that Canadian grain had. The wheat had to be able to recognize it at a glance if you knew it. so that anyone, the buyer too, would be look at it. Okay, sure. Well, that's what it is. And of course, it's a. It was apparently, and maybe still is, a real power in the marketplace to have that for Canadian wheat. As you look back over your years in the Grain Commission, what are you most proud of in the work that you did through those years?
I think the fact that I was able to work with all the members of our staff. I can And the same thing, like I say, I was fortunate with the elevators. I tried to treat everybody equally and as fair and as justly as possible. And as I look back, I think that everybody worked fair with me, as possibly as a result of And that, like I say, that's with the elevator and the inspection and the weighing staff, because we had a very close relationship with the weighing staff. And I felt I had a really good relationship with them all. And I was sorry when I left. I was very fortunate that I had the time in. I would be going to work for a third of my salary type of thing. The grain business was just starting to change. The number of ships, the size of the ships, the elevators in operation, all these things were just starting to change. Like I say, I really enjoyed going to work. I can't remember a day getting up and saying, "Well, I'm not going back there today."
Right.
You know, which I talking to people today, is not the situation.
In the Grain Commission.
They're threatening now of basically doing away with the commission.
Yes.
You know, so it.
Well, I listened to our member of Parliament, Bruce Heyer, describing a debate in the House just 10 days ago or so, I believe, when members were able to join in a filibuster and prevent the passage of the... In fact, they gave the six-month hoist to a bill that had the potential to see the... Is the whole inspection system disbanded, as a matter of fact?
Yeah.
Well, they gave it the six-month hoist, which is the way in which... A parliament kills a measure for this particular session. That's an enormous change. Would you want to sort of walk us through some other of the major changes that have took place in your work and in the work of the commission during these, how many years did we say again, 51 through 80, 38 years or so? The various possibilities, of course, the varieties that you had to deal with, changes in the ships, you've mentioned those, automation, I suppose.
Yeah, like I say, when I came on, it was an eight-hour day, and if they had a boat come in, and quite often, they would bring the unloading crew in, and the boat would cover the cost of the unloading crew. Because the elevator would say, "Well, we have to get what they're going to unload to put on that boat," which wasn't necessarily true, but it covered the cost. So when I left, it was basically a 24-hour a day job. If a boat came in at 2 o'clock in the morning, the elevator would start loading it, and we would have to put a staff.
And people would be aroused out of bed, or
they'd be on call.
I see.
When the last few years that I was on the job, they had what they call a flying squad, which meant that every elevator didn't have this was a means of cutting down on staff. Every elevator didn't have an unloading crew and a loading crew.
Mm-hmm.
So they had maybe five or six what they call flying squad set up. There might be one in the north end, two in the central end, and two out the other way. So they would get word that a boat is coming in. It'll be at Richland Elevator tonight at 6:30. You have it. And wherever it goes, you follow it.
Mm-hmm.
So it might finish there, or it could end up going up to to Searle or Grand Trunk or Grain Growers, but you followed the vessel.
And was the intention to complete the loading as quickly as possible?
It really didn't make any difference to the, because we just, wherever it went, we sampled it.
Yeah. But I mean, the fact that you were working through the night in these cases sense.
Yeah, right. It meant that in some cases the vessel would come in under normal conditions at 9 or 10 o'clock at night, which meant they had to sit there till 8 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
Well, this way they would, say, get a jump on it.
But how long did it take to load a? It would vary in different. Although I suppose the loading capacity increased as the ships got larger too. So was there a certain kind of a rule of thumb of how long it would take to load a ship?
These big ones, if you're say you go into an elevator that the ones that are left now are the bigger ones, Richardson's, Grain Growers, and Sass Pool. I would say maybe 10, 12 hours.
Mm-hmm. So a ship could come in at 10 at night and be leaving with sunrise.
Early in the morning, the next morning, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Of course, time is always is money, and so many of these connections.
Yes. Yeah.
And so things picked up. Yeah. The small ships, the canalers initially, then the Seaway, the Salties come in 1960 and so on. The ships keep getting larger. And this runs for maybe 25 years, give or take, a little bit more than that, because you were saying things were slowing down. Before 89, I expect, actually, the last few years that you were employed, things were getting slower.
Yeah.
When would you mark the decline really beginning?
Gets around the 80s, around the 80, 81, in that the boats, the new ones were coming. There's only I'm trying to think. The Toronto Elevator had some big ones, and Meisner had to put out a couple of big ones, and almost immediately their smaller boats that they had just stopped coming up.
Yes, I see. And that would be inevitable, I suppose. The bigger ships were just so much less expensive in terms of the men on them. Number of tons per crewman that you could move would make quite a difference. Did you have a sense of why the slowing took place in the 80s, whenever it really began? What did you think were the reasons at the time?
Well, there's a lot of shipping going to the Far East. Out of BC, the elevators got together and put a big elevator up in Prince Rupert, and it was, from what I understand, it was two or three of the grain companies went together, and so the grain from two or three companies went into that elevator. So if you had an order to go, and you were one company, and I was another company, that boat could go into the one elevator and get it all in one elevator.
Sure.
Where here, they'd have to go to Grain Growers to get some, then go to Richardson's to get some, and a lot of the trade was oil seeds, and oil seeds were going to China and going out of the West Coast.
So I got into politics, of course, in those years, and so I thought that the Western Grain Transportation Act lived up to its label. It was Western transportation.
And then they were talking about enlarging things up in Churchill. And,
yes. Yeah.
So that was out two or three times that they're going to do that, and then they said no, we're not, and they tore up all the tracks, and they said we're going to put them all back down again. So that's sort of up in the air. So.
Churchill has had its own mixed history, and the Atlantic business went down. Do you have any sense of the importance of Russia as a buyer impacting these things?
I think they used to get a fair amount, but I really don't know what the situation is now. Of course, I've always sort of claimed that we can blame ourselves for some of this. We used to have more trade commissions come over here, and we told them everything we knew. You know, how to grow grain, how to preserve it, how to dry it, everything. And then they went back to their own countries, and they started doing it. And they don't need our grain anymore.
No.
You know, it might be the wrong way to look at it, but I thought, geez, we...
Well, the first time I saw a picture of a Massey Ferguson combine, rather, I think it was, a good-sized one running a field in central France somewhere, I did sort of sit back in my haunches and say, so the French are doing that too? Yeah. And then when I saw a graph of wheat production in Saudi Arabia using irrigation, I think that was really the clincher. If the people are producing wheat for export, or even to meet their own needs in the first order, that's going to have an impact on Canadian sales through the Lakehead.
Sure.
To what extent did changes in the work of the commission, computerization, automation might be covering the whole thing in one word, how much of the inspection work could be automated in any way?
I mentioned before about the sheets and that Saspool had to have a separate paperwork. Before I left, every inspection office had a couple of computers. Well, at each grading area, and it was into the computer and up to the office. I remember them saying that technically, the check can be made out half an hour after the car has been unloaded and in the hands of whoever owns it out west.
Yeah.
Now, whether that ever happened or not, I don't know. And I remember at the time there were Apple, small Apple computers.
Oh, quality.
And
quality.
I said, you know, and right away, the majority of the experts said, you're not going to put one of those things in a government grain office in an elevator because there's so much dust and stuff in it. They're still working. They might have upgraded them a couple of times, but I just could not believe they put them in and it,
Well, if the Grain Commission was putting in Apple computers before you retired in 89, they really were on the cutting edge of getting PCs because the first Apple, 84 through 86, isn't it? A little later, I think, where this equipment is actually available.
Yeah, well, they,
so someone really jumped to it.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody was benefited from it or not, but I remember the day they hauled them in, they said, oh.
It would make things much more efficient, but it didn't necessarily, at the time, I suppose, reduce the number. Because the work of inspection simply required a great deal of hands-on activity. That couldn't be changed.
No.
I mean, one could conceivably have equipment making up. Although you'd want to watch the equipment to be sure that you were getting a real sample, I guess. That was part of the system.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking you could conceivably have it sucked up to some central place and one person with equipment doing it all and so on. But you would lose the assurance that the inspection was actually taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So it did require, through your working life through the 1980s, then the complement of inspectors in the city didn't decline, I suppose.
Well, it went down because all the elevators along the river, they were closing.
When there were fewer elevators.
Yeah.
That was the real determinant, the number of places to be inspected.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were there any other changes that took place through these years that might be significant? For yourself, moving up in the Grain Commission, changes didn't particularly...
Well, it gave me a little more money, but I've noticed when I looked on my list, when I got to be a P1, which was 65, I finally made $7,000 a year.
In 60, 60,
65.
65, yeah.
Just over the yearly salary, yeah. Which is...
Yeah, the numbers were small in those days. Yeah, the first time one went to a five-digit annual income. Oh, yeah. Great things.
Yes.
Well, this I dropped past a couple of questions about the way in which your work contributed to Canada's success as an international grain trader. I think we've really covered that along the way in terms of the importance of quality on the market, in the market, and so on and so forth, and the connections between your work and the work of farmers growing the grain, which you were handling. Well, you've mentioned that in several connections, in terms of the literal connection when they showed up to take a look at things and so on. What about challenges, leaving aside the matter of changes? Would you say there were challenges that you faced on the job?
I really can't think of anything that I would really say were a challenge.
Mm-hmm. I guess there were challenges the industry faced, but not necessarily you yourself.
No, I think the time that takes to do this and the time, everything wanted, they don't want it done today, they wanted it done yesterday type of thing. And but I really I can't think of anything that I would really classify as a challenge. It's, like I say, I was fortunate at a time that I wasn't involved with the Grain Commission, and that there was a number of vacancies and opportunity for promotion, and I was very fortunate to move up as I did. And it was a good time for the inspection and for the grain industry here in Thunder Bay.
Yes, well, and through the early 80s. And despite that international depression that mm-hmm. Paul Volcker and the Federal Reserve board in the U.S. almost caused in the early 80s, the grain business was really booming along.
Mm-hmm.
When I ran in the summer of 1984, Frank Mazur, who's one of my supporters in the campaign, was heading 1,800 men. Grain handlers up and down the waterfront, and these days... if they're 250 or 300 they're doing very well. It's enormous change since then.
Mm-hmm.
But you may have had the pleasure of being there through the heyday of the trade through the lakehead.
Yeah.
The changes as the elevators were closed and the business was concentrated in the largest and most efficient elevators would be a change that would have an impact, as you were saying. Mm-hmm. Fewer grain inspectors were needed. But otherwise, I suppose it continued as the
basic operation has stayed. I remember it was Gringor's M elevator. They put in new cleaners and cleaning and getting the grain ready for the vessels was the big thing, because it took time to clean it, and they put in new cleaners in that particular elevator, and anything that was unloaded up until midnight was ready for a boat by 8 in the morning, and that was, when that happened, that was unheard of. There's no way that you can put grain, and the thing is, it was all done with about three guys walking around the cleaner deck. The machines did it.
Yeah.
The manpower didn't.
Yeah.
They just set them up and they could. That was one of the big improvements, elevator-wise, was the speed in which they could, the speed of unloading cars because of the tankers, and the speed of the cleaning, and the fact that the size of the loading spouts being mechanically operated, led to a faster, more efficient operation.
Enormous changes in the transportation of the grain.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But the nature of the work that you had to do just didn't change
still
all that much.
Still basic. Yeah.
Yeah. Still basic. Yeah. Terribly simple in one way.
And like say now they're talking about getting rid of the grain commission.
Yes. You know? Yes, quite.
But the question has also been raised that if the inspection isn't done, I don't know if the weighing done, but if the inspection isn't done, and two companies load onto a boat, and at unloading, who are the buyer, isn't satisfied.
Yes, go ahead.
Who did it belong to?
Yes. I find myself wondering whether we aren't at this point, sort of at the latter end of a mania that's been going on for maybe a quarter century or more of deregulation, of removing government, letting industry self-administer and all the rest of it, because the food inspectors have these same concerns about the packing plans and whatnot, self-inspecting and assuring of quality and so on and so forth. And I wonder whether the what's happened in the financial sector in the U.S. over the past year or so isn't going to produce a turnaround in other areas as well, but it may take a while, and the Harper Conservative government is likely to be slow to move on these things. I mean, some of this is quite political in the government of the Parliament of Canada. Well, what we come down to, we're aiming to generate vivid stuff for our virtual grain trade center, you know. So one of the questions is, in fact, what are your most vivid memories about your job?
I remember walking the deck of boats in the beginning of December and never realizing that it could possibly get that cold. And, you know, they got skidoo suits and everything today. I remember the first thing I bought was a pair of felts and buckle overshoes, Carr's Mackinaw pants. I still got a pair. And I can't remember what kind of a parka. I think it was a Mackinaw parka. And the only good thing about the whole system was that the boats at that time had steam winches. And everybody that was on the boat would have their bum up against the big piston on the winches trying to keep warm. Today, they haven't got steam. I don't know how they keep warm now because it's all electric winches. I remember that. Oh, please don't have a boat tomorrow because it's going to be. But that's one of the things. And yet, it affected lots of people that way. And yet, the trimmers were a different breed because where we would have a boat today and maybe one in 3 or 4 days' time, they would be on boats every day. And I remember the last boat pulling out of here, and those guys would still have the top two buttons on their shirt undone.
Well, they'd been working inside the ship, though.
No, working up on deck. They were the hardest, hardy people. And they'd have a pair of mitts, and they'd be stuck in their back pocket, and they'd be pulling the rope with bare hands.
Tough.
Wow. Oh, yes. Those are the two differences, the two things that I definitely remember, the cold weather.
Are any other vivid memories?
not remember I guess it was the ocean boats when they first came up. I remember coming into Pool 7 and pumping the bilges out on the dock, which automatically ran into the basement, and the stench. And I think it was George McMacken, I think, was the boss there at the time. Boy, when they found out what was going on, they just hit the roof. And of course, after that, because they were pumping out above the dock, yeah. That it was one of the things that everybody was watching after that to make sure that. Yeah. Going to pump, and because it was the bilge water was picked up in the river down in wherever down the States, so it didn't mm-hmm. use terrible smell to it. And
I guess if it's inland water that's picked up, it could mm-hmm. well be sewage
yeah,
laden
yeah.
and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're quite right.
Yeah.
Another question is, in your mind, what were the most important events that happened in the workplace during your career? Do you have anything to add to what we've said about, there's a danger that of unnecessary repetition in some of these questions, given the fascinating things we've already talked about. Most important events. Anything to add?
Well, locally, it was going from. We went from the grain exchange to the post office building, the new post office building in the south of the work, which better facilitated the entire operation, because they had a when it was built, for an entomology lab and for a moisture lab, storage facilities for samples on rolling shelves, and just made everything so much easier for all the departments.
We should do a tour. That's the building where the Grain Commission still is.
No? Yes. Yeah.
We should do a tour of that building.
So that was one of the big changes from the old building. For those that worked up there, everybody didn't work up there, but for those of us that worked up there on different times,
mm-hmm.
It was such a difference from Chapel's building.
A real improvement.
Oh, yeah.
And designed, of course,
yeah,
to be that.
Completely different.
Well, I might ask whether you think it's important that we preserve and share the history of Thunder Bay's grain trade.
I think it's most important, and it's I guess like everything else. Well, we should do this, or this should be done, and it's in a lot of minds. But to get the wheels in motion, and I think that it definitely is a step in the right direction that. Along the same thing, I've been connected with the Sea Cadets in Thunder Bay since 1945. So they're celebrating 90 years next month, and I, whenever, the same as the grain business, whenever grain inspectors get together, we start reminiscing of names and stuff like that. Whenever three or four of the ex-cadets get together, we start reminiscing, and it always ends up as, somebody should be writing this down. Well, I think it's about 12 years ago, I started writing the cadet story. I'm still working on it, it doesn't happen overnight. But like I say, if the people that are involved in it now don't do it, it'll be lost.
Yeah,
you know, we're a throwaway society in more ways than one.
Yes,
and
the Thunder Bay's had a great record in thinking of buildings now, of knocking down and replacing over the years, too, as a, a sad reality, but in this area. Well, that's what we're about, and we might get some names from you before we conclude.
I'll just turn the machine back on, and Ernie,
Yeah, I see I've got notes here from, I'll just put Tal Morgan at the top of this one and have my pen ready as well as the, as well as having the machine going. Names of people who you worked with, not just not just grain inspectors for that matter, trimmers would be of interest as well.
Jim Monroe, I think it was Jim, was the inspector in charge, Thunder Bay. Bert Prescott,
and these are people who are still with us.
These are long gone. You want to
carry on with those?
Okay. Charlie Shepherd, Frank Varley, inspectors in charge. I'm trying to Johnny McIver, Norman McIver. Ken Jennings. These are filled basically up in the sample room that I was involved with early on the job. Jimmy Glenn. There's a number of fellows that meet now over the last Thursday of the month. That at the curling club there's Mo Harris, Ernie Duda, Cecil Thompson, Bill Rucola, Dieter Warmbold.
Dieter
Warmbold, W A R M B O L D. Frank Sarah Duke.
Sarah, S-A.
Sarah Duke.
Spelled it with a C-E-R-E, just guessing.
Jack Lowry.
We've already interviewed good old Mr. Lowry.
Is that right?
So this is a Thursday, last Thursday of the month, Curling Club, eh?
Yeah.
Which Curling Club? The
Port Arthur one.
Did you, do you know any grain trimmers who might be with us still, retired?
Tommy McKinnon from the church.
Oh, Tom McKinnon was a grain trimmer.
Oh, yeah, he was...
Ken Graham was a... Was he a grain trimmer, too? Ken and Helen Graham?
Might have been, but... The McKinnon family are... His dad was way, way back, and Tommy ended up being the one up in the... In chapels that... laid all the work on for everybody that... assigned the job. Tommy Jacobson.
These are trimmers.
Yeah, yeah.
Not related to the dentist by any chance.
I can't think.
Well, that's a couple of names. And, well, I'll certainly have a word with Tom. He's back for medical treatment, in good shape, I trust.
Yeah.
Sure. I think